So, we are going to focus, I'm going to have to just pick and choose. And so today I'm picking and choosing. Last week was about Ruth. This week's about, we're in 1 Samuel. This curriculum is going to try and go fast. I'll paraphrase a lot of it, but I actually think the most important part, not necessarily the most important part, but something that gets often skipped, and I do not want to do that, is Hannah. So 1 Samuel 1, we're actually going to start off by talking about Hannah. Hannah is Samuel's mom, and we start to see some patterns of what we've read in Abraham, and it's just, her story is indicative, but I will tell you that she is an absolute rock star. So I do want to read it, kind of highlight, because she makes a prayer at the end of chapter 1 that I want to dive into a little bit. Again, this teaching has required me to do a lot deeper dive into some stuff, which is really good for me, because this is not something that I reflected on much, because right after this story, and you have Samuel, and you have Eli, and stuff starts to pick up really fast. And the story is that a young man or boy likes to hear the stories of Saul and David and war and all these things and the grandeur, and he's trying to get into this this fast-paced, fun-to-read thing, and oftentimes we miss the little thing. And what I want to point out is this book is written very intentionally, and Hannah's at the very beginning of it. So what we're going to see is that her sorrows, her woes, and her prevalence through God is going to set up the stories that we're going to read about David and Saul. So let's get into this. I'm going to read a little bit this morning. I'm just going to start with 1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, and Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one wife was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Starting to sound familiar? Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he gave a double portion. Starting to sound really familiar, right? You have one wife that's bore kids, one wife that's barren, one wife that's loved, one wife that's not. And again, in this time period, what's the most important thing? Bearing children. Typically, the wife that was bearing children was the wife that was held in esteem. That socially, people are looking outside and saying, hey, this wife's barren. Something must be up there. This wife's having kids. The Lord's blessed them. And so we have this backwards thinking where the double portion is given to the wife with no kids. Think about, we've talked about it a lot. Who gets the double portion in offspring? The firstborn. Right? And so not only in this moment is Elkanah taking away from his wife that's less loved, but also his offspring. And so And again, this is not, when God is condoning something, it's typically sin. In this instance, we don't have the approval yet. And I think we're going to get into that, and I think it's important to point that out at the beginning. And her rival, her sister wife, used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. Who closed her womb? The Lord. Keep that in mind as we go forward. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, remember me and not forget your servant, but will give your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. We're starting to see some Sermon on the Mount. What did Kevin talk about when he was talking about the meek and the poor in the spirit? And it's going to come up again. It's the afflicted. And Hannah's praying and saying, hey, Lord, look upon the affliction of your servant. Remember me and do not forget your servant, but will give your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman, and Eli said to her, how long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, again, listen to the words. But Hannah answered, no, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I am a woman troubled in spirit. Remember how we're talking about spirit. Spirit is your energy, your life force. Spirit is breathed into you by God. And what she's saying is, hey, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I'm afflicted. My sister wife is coming down and she's always nagging and nagging. The people around me are looking down upon me because I can't bear any offspring. I'm afflicted and I'm troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with the 3-year-old bull, and an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord and at Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli, and said, O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing in your presence praying to the Lord for this child, I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And he worships the Lord there. Wow. Right? We have these parallels between Abraham, and we have the when God calls Abraham to give up his son Isaac. And then we have a woman in the same, just a few books later, that said, God, give me a child and I will give him to you. Willingly gives up her child to God. I know my wife would not be excited about that. And I also know any mom's probably not too excited about that. But what I do know is Hannah is showing faithfulness to her promise, to her vow, and to God. And we're about to get into a prayer that's powerful. It's Hannah's prayer. 1 Samuel chapter 2, it begins. But I want us to reflect on what she did and her actions. Her prayer in the beginning is, help me, I'm afflicted, I'm poor in spirit. If we flip to the Sermon on the Mount, it says, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Blessed are the afflicted. Blessed are the meek. We start seeing these things play out. I've told Dad to talk about the Sermon on the Mount, and he's done a good job so far, but there's so much to dig into. And if you start reading it, which I hope y'all have read it at least once this week, but if y'all have started reading it, you see it flesh out throughout the whole Bible. Hannah's prayer is going to reflect so diligently what Christ is going to say years and years later. Hannah's prayer, 1 Samuel chapter 2. And Hannah prayed and said, my heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. By horn, we don't have a ton of time, so I'm just going to say it. In Psalms, it talks, David writes a poem about, this is a picture of victory. The horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the who are broken? The weak? The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. That's the end of her prayer, but wow, does she hit on a lot that we're, and again, this prayer, this first, however many verses, 40 verses, I mean, is setting up the rest of the Bible. But again, I want us to reflect, who closed Hannah's womb? The Lord. Who is Hannah faithful to? The Lord. Elkanah is not super prevalent in this story, right? These stories are just very intentional. It's Abraham doesn't take offerings when he goes and rescues all his people. Why? Because he says, I'm not going to take anything from you because I don't want people to look and say, oh, y'all have made me rich. He had opportunities at immediate wealth and he passed it up because he's like, I only want one person to be able to take credit for where I stand. And we're in the same spot here. And Hannah's prayer is powerful. If y'all aren't seeing the connection to the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, it's incredible. When the bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. He brings low and he exalts. I mean, we can break this down and we will to an extent, but I know Mr. Buzzer Happy over there is going to get me in not too long. But she makes this amazing, this poem, this prayer. It says Hannah's prayer, but it's really a poem. It's almost, if you took this and you put it in Psalms, it would fit right in, right? This is a poetry. This is a giving glory to God. And what she's saying is, hey, he takes the lowly. Because Hannah was in the position of lowly. Socially lowly, in every way lowly. Hannah was in a position of lowly. And God takes Hannah and bores to her a son, Samuel, that's going to be, very prevalent throughout the Bible, throughout the kings, this is somebody who people look up to. And what I want to point out early, because I know it's gone fairly evenly through the Bible. But Hannah's making this prayer that's very similar to what we read in Matthew. There's another sermon that's really close in resemblance in Luke as well. And what time period is she living? These are the hellfire brimstone days. No, go ahead.
But also, I think it's important to talk about, like, when Jesus was doing the Sermon on the Mount, he is re-delving back into those connections from the Old Testament, because he's preaching to predominantly Jews, right, who know all of these stories, know all of the history that's laid out in Samuel, and these massive prophets that were prophets from the Jews. So his words were very intentional and very specific to correlate the relationship that he's making, you know, about his coming, right? And I think that's something we forget, is most of these people knew all these stories very, very well, just like we know tons of stories of our childhoods, whether they're, you know, the fairy tales or different things like that. These people in the society knew all the stories of St. Mendel and Hannah and the prayer that you're speaking about and everything. So it's a very intentional act that Jesus is doing when he's preaching up there, you know, and very deliberate.
Yes. He is a very, he pulls from all over the place and reflects bunch of scripture in those short 100 verses. But again, two sides of the Bible that some people don't even go back and look at this one. Different gods, separate gods. We're saying the same thing in both. Hannah's prayer here is on point. And your mind has to go to, like Jason said, the Torah, the first five books, is stuff that they grew up knowing. She's a Jew. This claim of who God is was built on the Torah. This claim that she's praying that God will raise up the lowly, that he brings people from the ashes to sit on thrones of princes, this claim is from the first five books that we don't often like to look at because it's the hellfire brimstone God. So, when we look at it that way, are we missing something? Because we have this afflicted woman that's looked on lowly because she can't have kids, that her husband's other wife is just brutal to her. This afflicted woman that God gives a child, and she is faithful with that child to her promise with God. How many of us make promises to God? Yeah, I'm a car salesman, so I do it a lot. All right, I guess I just can't flip that switch. You ever feel like your negotiation's in the wrong way? I'm not advocating for that. That's not a great thing. But I've been there, right? And right here, we have a woman who made a promise and that is very diligent with it. And then in the time where you would think that it's the most difficult, right? She's giving up her son. She makes this amazing claim in this poem, in this prayer of who God is. It's pretty incredible. There's a lot of stuff that I wish we could read through. I guess I'm preaching today too, so I have a lot of stuff kicking around in my head, and I'm trying not to spoil anything. And I'm trying not to forget anything also. But I wanted to start with Hannah because she, gives this amazing prayer. Again, you have a family asked to give up their son that was promised. You have an afflicted woman that God takes care of. These stories are highly repetitive and different, in different lights and different ways. But again, it all points to Messiah. Because we'll start moving on again. But Hannah bore Samuel. Samuel gets dropped off with Eli. And to paraphrase, because I don't want to run out of time, Eli's sons are in Shiloh. They talked a little bit about them. What are they doing? Not good stuff. Stealing from God, doing things the way God would not want them to do, and God condemns that. Eli, typically somebody that's fairly looked up to as a father figure, and I do appreciate that your books go through this, also does not put a stop to his sons doing wicked stuff in the house of the Lord. And so, next week we have Saul, so I'm going to kind of skim through some of this. But Samuel starts to grow in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord comes to Samuel in a vision, and he says, "Hey, get ready, because I'm about to take out the house of Eli." And it's a vision, and God calls him several times, and he says, Samuel. And he wakes up and he goes to Eli and he said, yes, my Lord. He's like, I didn't call for you. He comes back. Samuel goes to Eli. Yes, my Lord. Nothing. And then Eli perceives, hey, God's talking to you. And this is, again, a point I want to make to Samuel, and I know this is so much information, but your books did it to me. I'm sorry. Eli perceives that God's calling Samuel, and so Eli sends him back in, and the next time God calls Samuel, Samuel responds and says, yes, my Lord, your servant is here. And God says, hey, I'm about to wipe out the house of Eli. And you're next up. Then we have this battle, and I do think this is an important part because it used to bug me. I don't know if it bugs anybody else, but the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to read that. 1 Samuel chapter 4, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought it from there, the Ark of the Covenant and the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, what does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean? And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come up to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, a god has come up into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight. There's this mighty cheer, right? The Ark of the Covenant comes in, and then what happens? They get slaughtered. When you read that at first, you're like, oh, get the boys fired up, right? We're going into battle. The Ark of the Covenant is here. And even the Philistines are like, hey, how are we going to do this? This is the God that plagued Egypt. This is the God that brought them out of the wilderness. This is the God, or they say gods, that we've heard stories of. So they're already scared, and then you read it, and you're like, all right, here we go. The Lord's about to prevail, and then what happens? They're slaughtered. And this is what I really appreciate about the book that y'all have in your hands, hopefully, the lesson. Because this is something I've never thought about. It just bothered me. They're toting the Ark of the Covenant around like a trophy. Guess what they don't do? They don't involve God in that decision. Guess what you don't hear? The priest praying and asking God what to do. The priest praying and saying, hey, Lord, what should we do? The priest, what we've seen in the past is prayers and saying, hey, God, should I go out against these people? God saying, yes. God saying, no. What we don't have here is any input from God. We we have these people toting around the Ark of the Covenant to get an army fired up. And it probably got them fired up. Guess what they don't have? God. The throne of the Almighty God toted out, and God is not sitting on it. Right?
And I think there's a little bit of underlying symbolism in that as well, because what are they also doing during this time? A lot of idol worship. So are they worshiping the ark, or are they worshiping God? And so I think that it's some additional reinforcement of what one of the major core issues that's occurring right now is that they're putting more faith in a tangible, physical thing instead of what it should be.
Yes, great point. They're toting it around without God's approval, without anything, which means they're worshiping the ark. They get riled up about the ark. Nobody ever said, "Hey, Lord, you sitting there right now, or you back at home? Where are you?" They just towed it around. A great point. It's just another means of idol worship, which we can see a church, a podium, all these things that we can put up and say, "Hey, we need this here. Hey, we need this there. Hey, this needs to be exactly like this. Hey, this needs, hey, this needs, hey, this needs." Where's God? If we're not keeping the main thing, then we're missing the whole point. We could have the Ark of the Covenant sitting in this room. If we're just toting it around like that, it means nothing. The Ark of the Covenant was beautiful. They had the best people make the best stuff in these great carvings and the cherubim, and I imagine it was stunning beyond all belief. But what's its value if God's not sitting on his throne? What's its value if it's empty? In this case, not even its weight in gold, because what we see happen is that the Philistines take the ark and then they take it to a camp, and what starts happening? They're plagued. And they're like, "Hey, we don't want this here anymore. We gotta get this out of here." And so God is still working, but it took it leaving for God to come back. Because what did the Philistines realize? And this is a crazy thing, but I think it's important. The Philistines realized that this is where their God is. And then the Philistines double realized that, hey, this is the God with the power, because we bring it into our camp, and guess what starts happening? We get plagued. And so they send it out, and the next people get it, and they're like, "I don't want this here. Why are you trying to do this?" Right? I know we went through a lot super fast, but he's about to bless me. Read this story. Next week we have an introduction to Saul. And what I want us to, and I told you a brief snippet about it at the very beginning of this, and I want to reflect, is that this story of Hannah was highly intentionally placed at the very beginning to set up, and this is what I love about the Bible, is they do this often. This story sets up what we're going to read through 1 and 2 Samuel. Fun little tidbit, because I like fun facts. 1 and 2 Samuel are actually one scroll. Split into two. It's not, this was a coherent piece of writing. Our Bible splits a lot of stuff up to make it kind of easier to follow, or to give us stuff to, like, places to reflect on, because nobody wants to say, "Hey, this is on the 3031st line of this scroll." So, not bashing how our Bible's written, I'm just saying this is one whole scroll. And what you have in Hannah is this picture of God raising up the oppressed to send somebody down to help God's people. And what we're going to have and what we're going to see, and Hannah ends on a high note, right? She has this amazing claim to who God is at the end of her tidbit. And her son Samuel is a great reflection of who we should be, of who Christ hasn't happened yet, but a great reflector of godly attributes. And then we have this call for a king. Matt, well, go ahead.
Well, and I think that's important for us to understand is the parallels that Christ is making, you know, later in life, and because there is a lot of talk of the Messiah through Samuel, of the status of Israel when that person shows up or when that discussion starts happening. Because a lot, if you go back a couple chapters, right, they were being conquered and being beaten up and all this other stuff, and then Eli comes on, and everything's good for a while, right? And I forget the exact time frame, but it's like a period of time where he's raising this huge family and he's being placed in a positional authority, and Israel's doing well and they're kind of the big guys and every life's going pretty well, and all of a sudden it's not. And so the symbolism you're talking about, not only going up there and the ark being taken up and, like you said, all this foreboding of victory, and then it doesn't happen and the ark being taken and all of that sanctity of Israel being pulled away and the curtains kind of being pulled back and showing the filth beneath it is essential, I think, to the discussion of what's going about to happen, because the stepping up of Samuel and the re-cleansing of Israel and the recalibration and the alignment back with God is this talking point. Because it says, I think, right, and again, this is me just thinking of, is Jesus is kind of making the same parallels with where the Israel was at the time of him being there. Is that they are very similar to the times. And I think that would have been very clear and transparent to the people of Israel, is him essentially comparing them to the Eli's version of Israel. And you may have all these Pharisees and all this prosperous and all this other stuff, but you have the same amount of corruption.
Right. And along that lines, one more thing that I want to point out, just back to the ark and Jason's point, is what do they ask for after this? They're begging for a king. What did they look at the ark as? They're begging for something tangible that they can hoist up high in a battle. They're begging for a trophy or a leader or just something, right? And each time that they're doing that, a matter of fact, and we'll get into it next week, Samuel is angry when the people are begging for a king. He's angry. And God comes to him and he says, and again, this is a little tidbit, snippet, intro for next week. God comes to him and says, hey, why are you mad? They're rejecting me. They're looking to you for an answer. They're looking to who for an answer? Samuel. Who are they rejecting? Me. Over and over, and this is, I mean, you can get into the Hosea story, you can get into, I mean, this is just repetitive. It's God's people keep rejecting him. So why should it have been any surprise when Christ's people reject him? Like, this is shown biblically over and over and over that when God's people are pushing against Moses, who are they not looking at? God. Go ahead, you're fine. When we see them turn on Moses, again, it's turned in the wrong place. When they see him turn towards an ark, they're forgetting God. When we're about to see him turn against Samuel, not against Samuel, just turn to him for him to appoint the next king or the first king, it's a rejection of God. And so over and over and over we have this. And then kings are put in place, prophets were put in place for the same reason, is we have these wonderful stories that we tend to put people on a pedestal but always fall short. that may have glimpses of the right thing, but always fall short. Go ahead, Joe.
Same as now. They kind of forget to look back to God's word, and then things fall away.
We do that all the time, right? We like to put...
But at the same time, we have Hannah, who made a promise to God. She went through with her promise to God, and because of that, of course, Samuel.
Isn't it funny how the Bible introduces us to Hannah, and we see this amazing story of who she is, and she makes this amazing claim about God, and we see this woman back in this time, and then right afterwards, we see shortcomings of kings. And what the Bible likes to do, especially in the Hebrews, is say that God is greater than whoever you want to put in that bubble, right? And we have this amazing introduction to Hannah and who she is, and then we learn that, hey, even Hannah kind of had her stuff straightened out a lot better than Saul. Even, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
As
a mom, I would struggle. Eli has raised two boys who are not faithful, who are not obedient. I would have a really hard time giving my son up to somebody who's already failed.
But that's, I don't know if you're going to finish, but I'm going to finish it for you. That's missing it.
Oh my gosh.
Who's she giving him to? God. She doesn't say, I'm going to go give him into Eli's hands. He's like, hey, the boy is waiting. It's time to give him into God's hand. And she trusts, again, yes, a hard position to be in. Like, hey, this guy is screwing a lot of stuff up. Am I really going to let my son learn under him? But again, in Hannah's right viewing of what this is going to look like, she never says Eli. She says, hey, God, I promised you this, and I know you're going to take care of it. Because why? Because you've been faithful for everything that I've asked for so far. You've been faithful to me. Sorry, I finished it for you.
It's still a struggle.
That's again just a testament to who Hannah is. Now one of my favorite Bible characters. Thank y'all.
So handsome.